All right. Well, good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming. My name is Joe Farrell. I work with International Justice Mission. So you all know what I've kind of been asked to just talk about is a little bit about the theology of biblical justice and why that ought to compel us as the church to move into to kind of scary and dark places in the world, like issues of human trafficking, modern-day slavery. So if that's not what you want to hear about, I'm not offended if you get up and want to go find a seminar that is more to your liking. That would be just fine. My plan for this time, about an hour and 15 minutes, I'm going to share a little bit about my journey and how I ended up at IJM and my journey into this thing called biblical justice and what it means. And then we're going to look at some scriptures. And then I'm going to talk about a few different types of what we define as injustice at IJM and how we go about addressing some of those things. And human trafficking is one of those things, and so I'll tell you a story related to that as well, but also give you insights or just stories into a couple other types of injustice that we see in the world every day. Near the end of our time together, Dorothy Taft is here from the Market Project, so she's going to tell you a little bit about that. And then I'm hopeful that we'll have ample time for question and answer and some conversation around some things too. Sound good? So if there are questions along the way, write those down, and then sort of in the last block of time, we'll definitely get to those. So again, biblical foundations for justice. And so I want to start just with a really common Old Testament scripture. If you are my age, which is, I can say I'm now 40, I feel like I finally entered adulthood, which is wonderful. If you send kids off to camp, kids my age, you grew up with actually singing this song in camp. Like we turned this little verse into a worship song. Like, he has shown thee, O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of thee, but to do justice, with a nice little echo, and to love mercy, and a nice little echo, and to walk humbly with your God. It is a great, convenient verse to memorize and to sing. And I grew up sort of this song, one of those refrains, just in my head, and I knew it. And then I went to college at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and I went there because I was a big fan of college football and snow skiing. And at that time, they had really good both of those there. I went to the business school, and my dream or my desire was to do well in business school and then become a really successful entrepreneur who would support the church and missionaries financially. Like, that was kind of what I wanted to do. And then when I graduated, I didn't want to jump right into the workplace, and so I did an internship at First Presbyterian Church in Boulder. And that environment of being a Christian in Boulder, where there was no social value to being a Christian, there was no incentive, there was no reason to do it. In fact, you'd be setting yourself up for ridicule or just being offhandedly discounted because you were a Christian, really refined my faith a lot. It was in the early 90s, it was very much a post-Christian environment. Really shaped my faith, and so I wanted to do 1 year as like an intern at the church in Boulder, still thinking of my plan was the right way to plan. And then halfway through that year, went to Urbana, which is InterVarsity's Missions Conference. At that time, they still had it at Champaign-Urbana, the university. And in the midst of that, there was this real clear call on God saying, I want you to serve the church. Long story, but that's the short version of it. And so I came out of Urbana, and I was kind of in a wrestling with God mode, because this wasn't my plan. I was supposed to go be a successful entrepreneur, make a lot of money, support the church. But God reminded me that I also thought I was supposed to be 6'2", 220 pounds, ripped, and fast. And so sometimes our plans just don't happen. So at that point, I began searching in God and saying, well, okay, if I'm going to serve the church, I've got to do it in something that I like doing. And God was so merciful to me, so gracious. So allow me to actually start serving in college ministry. So I started a college ministry at First Presbyterian Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, with students from Wake Forest University and three other small schools in Winston-Salem. North Carolina School of the Arts, which is one of three state-funded art schools. They get students the caliber of Juilliard. Salem College, it's 500 undergrad, all women school. liberal arts education, and Winston-Salem State University, a historically black college and university. And trying to reach students from those four different campuses all at once just rocked me. It was such a challenge and such a puzzle. And that's where this issue, some issues around justice and what is justice, what does it mean? And I was serving in a conservative PCUSA church. And so for many of you, that would, it would feel a lot like what I think a lot of the, what a liberal PCA church and a conservative PCUSA are often more alike than they are, like, right, the opposite sides of that. So better or worse, that's just the reality of where our landscape is in the Presbyterian world and our Reformed brotherhoods. And so there was this hesitancy around the issue of what we were calling social justice. Because something happened in maybe in the 60s or 50s or maybe even earlier, maybe back in 1910, that churches began to be forced to choose. Are you going to be social justice or are you going to be gospel? And as the churches began to do this in our mainline denominations, they began to get further and further apart. And this is my opinion, so you can totally push back on me on this. But my assessment, my opinion of the landscape. And so churches began to make this choice and fall into this sort of false dichotomy of either social justice or gospel. So one of the things that we're approaching at IJM in the world is say, we think that might have been a false separation, a false dichotomy. To take justice out of the gospel might have been a little bit too extreme. So we're talking about biblical justice. To try to get, what does the scriptures tell us about justice? So that it isn't wrapped up in politics. It isn't wrapped up in even necessarily domestic issues. It isn't liberal or conservative. It isn't Republican or Democrat. That's not what we want to talk about. What we want to engage is, what does the scripture say about justice? Because it's clearly there. Like, what does the Lord require of you? That to three things: do justice, to love kindness or love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. But if I feel like we find scriptures like this in places like Micah 6:8, and Micah's a minor prophet, so you know it's not really like major, or we call it a major. No, so we kind of find ways to just take messages like this from Scripture and put them away. And that's I'm telling you my story, my testimony with justice. Like, I liked Micah 6:8, but I also like to keep it in the category of minor. And so then about three or four years ago now, I was serving at First Presbyterian Church in Colorado Springs, a large church in downtown Colorado Springs. Was a preaching pastor and senior leadership there, and also over the young adult supervising staff, college and young adult. And our young adult community began to get interested in this issue of human trafficking. And they're saying, you know, we're hearing about this, and it just doesn't sound like it's something that God would be pleased with. Like, it sounds like slavery, and aren't we supposed to be against this kind of stuff? So we started organizing these nights of awareness about global human trafficking, and we'd pair it with prayer and worship. Because after facing the realities of the inhumanity and the horror of human trafficking, the only thing that we knew how to do, because we were young adults, like early career people, like we didn't have a lot of money, couldn't send a lot of money, the only thing that we felt like we could do was to pray, to cry out to God for mercy, for action, for movement, and then to worship God. Because that God's the only one who could really change something on a scale like it is today. So we began to sort of feel our way through this, and not really knowing what we were doing, but just felt like it was important. And so out of that flow, we began to say, you know, as a young adult community, we ought to study what Scripture says about justice and about issues like slavery and abuse. So we launched into this study, and we were studying scriptures like Isaiah chapter 1, which is a really profound and challenging chapter to study with this idea of justice and what it means. And then we actually got into several Old Testament passages. We're starting to move into the New Testament passages, and I actually have a dream. Now, I told you I'm a Presbyterian ordained pastor. I've been educated, Gordon Conwell theological. I have been conditioned to doubt my dreams. Because our Reformed tradition, our sinful selves, like any dream could be a product of my brokenness, my depravity. So I woke up from this dream, and I'll tell you what it was. And I don't usually remember dreams, and this one was vivid to me. And it wasn't of any person. It was just a picture of a scale. And I was being interviewed. And the first questions started coming at me were like, how much time have you spent preparing a great turn of phrase for a sermon that people might find memorable or witty? It's like, oh, yeah. It's like a weight went up on the scale. And how much time have you spent planning short-term mission trips? Wait a minute. How much time have you spent thinking of the just perfect right worship song to follow your sermon? And a weight went up. And how much time have you spent in all these good things around the life of the church was being asked, and I kept putting these weights up. And then the line of questioning changed. And the question was, how much time have you spent doing justice? No weight went up. How much time have you spent loving mercy? Well, I love mercy for myself. So a little weight went up. How much time have you spent walking humbly with God? Second most humble person I know. Another little weight went up. How much time have you spent caring for orphans? How much time have you spent pleading the case of the widow? How much time have you spent visiting or releasing those people trapped in prison? Like, no weights are going up for all these questions. So I wake up from this dream and I share it with my wife and I start to just tell a few other people about it. And there's not like really a consensus or anything of great discernment about it. And then later on that week, in my own devotional reading and study, I'm in Matthew 23. And Matthew 23 is Jesus preaching the woes to the scribes and Pharisees. He's giving them the warnings. All these, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, for you have, da, 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 da. Matthew 23:23. Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, for you have tithed your mint and your dill and your cumin, but you have neglected the weightier matters of the law. Justice, mercy, and faith. And then Jesus says an amazing thing. Better that you had done both than done one and neglect the other. And suddenly that dream just blew up in my head. Because I realized I was living the very warning that Jesus was giving to the Pharisees. That I've been living this life of doing good things. So mint and dill and cumin are the lightest of the spices that the Pharisees would be required to tithe. And they'd measure out 1/10 of those spices to give to the temple. And Jesus is saying, you know, you've done all the good religious work, but you've missed these weightier matters. And as I assessed my own life and my own ministry, and even the ways that I had been shaping and forming disciples, the conviction came heavy on me that I had been an out-of-balance disciple, that I'd been doing the things that we, most of us, love doing in the church, like the fellowship, the worship, the study and the preaching, the things that come naturally to a lot of us, especially, I would say, in the Reformed traditions. But we've been neglecting those weightier things, justice, mercy, and humble faithfulness. And so I just decided, and after sharing with my wife, that I needed to rebalance my own journey. Like, I needed to produce disciples who are balanced. I needed to live in a more balanced approach. So I needed to figure out what this justice and this mercy piece meant. So I started looking in some other places, other scriptures, and then I started to come across more and more scriptures like this. So Psalm 45:6. Your throne, O God, will last forever and ever. A scepter of justice will be the scepter of your kingdom. So now, most of my life I would just read that and fly right over it. Now I read it and it stops me because of this little key phrase of justice and what does it mean in this context. So, for an ancient Jew who's singing this psalm, when they come to this in the psalm, and they sing about the throne and God on the throne and a kingdom that lasts forever and ever and a scepter, what do you think pops into their mind? So you have to go way back to ancient Judaism and the Jewish people and the kingdom, right around David's time even. What are they thinking when you hear scepter?
Get hit.
Of who?
Get hit.
Well, it could be something to hit. Yeah, they're like something like a mace, yeah?
Staff.
It's a staff. The most popular scepter in our culture today comes from the movie The Avengers. Loki, the bad guy, has this long thing with a blade on the end. And it tells you everything you need to know about his kingdom. His is a kingdom of violence and tyranny. But an ancient Jew who was singing this psalm would think of the scepter of Pharaoh. The most powerful kingdom in that day and in their history until later on when Romans and Greeks sort of arose was this the scepter of Pharaoh in Egypt. And the Pharaoh would hold the scepter, and it was a symbol of Pharaoh's absolute rule over the entire kingdom of Egypt. But it also was a symbol of his utter commitment to Egypt alone. So you see how it was a two-way? So Pharaoh's scepter is a symbol of his ultimate authority over the entire realm, but it's also a sign and symbol of his ultimate commitment to be the servant of that realm. And so when the scripture then says, when the psalm says that his... see, that's being recorded? I'm just kidding. it says, your scepter, O Lord, will be, a scepter of justice will be the scepter of your kingdom. There's this poetic image of the thing that makes the kingdom work and survive and thrive is justice. And that's different than what I had understood justice to be, as kind of an optional thing that a few people who are passionate about it could do. But it implies that God is actually a God of justice. That God is just. The same way we say God is other things, like God is merciful, God is compassionate, God is just. And so in my study of this, I began to wonder more and more, where is it that we reflect this in our own personal discipleship? That we might engage in this work. And so another psalm, Psalm 10, the beginning of Psalm 10 actually talks about, or earlier in the verses 10, 11, 12, talks about this scene of like a lion crouching and waiting for to pounce on its prey. Or how people will, you know, cast their nets on others and drag them off into slavery. And to our modern ears, it kind of sounds melodramatic because we don't see people get nets thrown on them and dragged off into slavery. But at the end, this part of Psalm 10, the end of the psalm, O Lord, you hear the desires of the meek. You will strengthen their heart, for you incline your ear to do justice for the orphan and the oppressed, so that those from the earth may strike terror no more. So, Jim, one of the things we like to just to talk about and to engage is this idea that God actually hates injustice. He actually wants it to stop. So Gary Haugen, our founder's first book, The Good News About Injustice, is actually the good news about injustice is that God hates it. And he's against it. And he wants that to stop. He wants it to be different. And so we're really careful to define injustice. Because it is a word in our culture that's growing popularity, could have so many meanings that it doesn't mean anything. And so when I'm preaching about this with churches, what I'll often share is this analogy of when you go to the grocery store and you have 9 or 10 items on your list. And so you just grab that little green basket, you get your 9 or 10 items. Then you go to the express checkout line. And someone's there, and you get in that line, and what's the first thing you start doing? You count how many items they have in their basket. And they're putting them up there, and as you're standing there, and you're like, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. They have 13 items. This is 10 items or less. Okay, that feeling, that is not injustice. Not what we're talking about. We actually are talking about a specific kind of sin described in the scriptures. That's when one person abuses their power to take from another person the good things that God intends for all of creation, for all of his created people. Namely, their life, their liberty, their dignity, and the fruits of their love and their labor. So when any one person and use any kind of power, physical, emotional, coercive, drug-related, whatever it might be, when one person's abusing power to take from others any of those good things, that's what we say is injustice. So IJM, that's the kind of stuff that we want to call the church to engage in. That there's this, often there's this pairing in Scripture of righteousness and justice. And righteousness is most often, we describe it as our right relationship with God. Like we're restoring ourselves to rightness in that relationship, right? But is that a fair, more or less, kind of broad definition of righteousness? It's restoring our right relationship with God. What's that justice piece? So if righteousness and justice are paired, what I often say is that righteousness is that sense of restoring a right relationship of people to the Creator. Justice is restoring the right relationship of creation to the Creator. So when things are going wrong in the world that God designed, that is where injustice is happening. And both unrighteousness and injustice affect people. And God's restoration of creation is both about restoring righteousness and restoring justice. So the call that we have as followers of Jesus, as people of God, is to move into the spaces not only of creating spaces to transform people in righteousness, but also creating spaces of justice where people can thrive and where they're not being suffering from their injustice. And so,
good question. What's the dictionary say about the meaning of justice?
So it's a dictionary say about the meaning of justice. So there's probably a lot of definitions. And it related to public, criminal, all sorts of. So we're talking about biblical justice, specifically what the Bible says.
Okay, and that's in the dictionary?
I haven't looked at which dictionary.
I wonder if you're using the right word, but
that's
okay.
Well, I'm just using the word from the Bible. And this is the English Bible, which most of us are using. So if we're going to change the word, we need to change the whole of the English canon. Yeah. So we see in places like Isaiah 1:17, God's really clear call for his people. And if we had time, we could do a real long, thorough study of all of Isaiah, where you can see there's this picture of the people in the beginning of Isaiah, and they're crying out to God, like they want God to be involved with them. And in this section of Isaiah, God is saying, like, I'm sick of your new moon Sabbaths, or your new moon festivals, and your Sabbath days, and the feasts, and the fasting. It's like, is not the fast that I want from you to do good, to seek justice, to rescue the oppressed, to defend the orphan, to plead for the widow? And so what we do at IJM, then, is to engage in these kind of very things.
I can say the best definition right there.
Okay.
That's the best example.
Yeah. So great, and so we use that one very commonly. So we do one of our casework type, and we're going to have some time for questions at the end. So I'll push through all this stuff, and then we'll have a good time for conversation. So one of the types of casework that we do is related to widows in North Africa, and so imagine the situation of the Lord's Republic Army, the Kony situation, and so they all come in, and so what happens is all of these widows take off. They want to protect their children. They don't need their children being taken in as child soldiers, and so they run, and then they're displaced for 5 or 10 years. And so when they return to the place where their lands used to be, it used to be their lands were marked off. Well, from that banana tree over to where that stone is it's like that's how they're. Land is marked off. Well, they come back to find out either that everything's been slashed and burned, so those landmarks aren't there, or it's just all grown up. Like, everything's overgrown, you can't even see the rock anymore because it's covered, or there might be several trees in the area where there's just one. And so what happens, they're trying to stake out where they think their land was, And some of these people who used to be in like these armies are now just groups of thugs and gangs of bullies. And if you are a widow with children in Africa, and you want to be able to provide anything for your family, the number one thing you need is land so that you can farm it and use it for livestock so you can actually provide sustenance for your family. And so when a bully comes by or a group of thugs and they want to run you off and they have spears and machetes, and or your husband has died and his brother comes and says, you can't have the land, this is my brother's land and now it's my land. What's to prevent that bully from running that widow right off? And when you think about that, widows in the world today are in care of 250 million children. Widows alone care for 250 million children. So they need land. So they need protection. So Grace's story, and if I had Wi-Fi here in the room, I could show you a video, but I would encourage you to visit our website. Just search Grace's story, and you can hear in her words and then translated in subtitles below of what it's like to be run off your land and what it's like to try to run down that land so you can actually have the title and deed so you might actually be able to provide for your family, what it's like to be in a home where they'll come by at night and actually push the home in on you to try to run you off, what it's like to have planted crops and worked there and then to have them come by and cut them all down in hopes that you'll just die. So the types of injustice that we want to fight and the types of people we want to work for are women like Grace and her children, so that we can actually see justice done. Care for the widow, protect the orphan. The kinds of things that God asked us to do. To be the church and to some of those heavier, as Jesus said, weightier things. How we participate in those things. So there's other scriptures that we have in places like Hebrews, to remember those who are in prison as though you were in prison with them, those who are being tortured as though you yourselves were being tortured. Yeah, that's a high call. Like, if we actually are serious about what the scriptures are asking us to do, as though we were in prison with them. And so in places in Kenya, for example, we represent people like Joseph. In one of our studies of the Nairobi Remand prison where Joseph was held, IJM and our partners figured that there's as many as 20 to 40% of the prisoners in Nairobi Remand are innocent. So what happens is pretty typical, like in Joseph's story. So Joseph ran a small marketplace in a popular Nairobi area. They didn't need to make a ton of money, but enough to feed his wife and his five children. His wife, Anne, was pregnant with their sixth. And there's a riot in the marketplace. And the police show up to disperse the riot. And this is in 2012. Some of you may remember there were some riots related to elections in Kenya during that season. So one of these riots in the Nairobi slums, in the marketplace, and the police show up and to disperse the riot, they just start shooting their guns in the air. And somehow Joseph is accidentally struck in the arm by one of these bullets. And so later, at the end of the riot, so it turns out one of the police officers ends up losing their firearm. And when you are not a police officer in Kenya and you lose your weapon, you are in line for a huge penalty. So this officer and a few of his buddies, in order to protect him, fabricate a story. And they return to the same slum, and they find out Joseph has been shot, and they find a few other guys who got scrapes and bumps during the riot. And they fabricate a story, and they say Joseph started the riot and attacked the police officer to try to steal his weapon, and that's why he was shot. So they grab Joseph and a few other poor people who live in that area, and they throw him in jail, and they say, case solved. And Joseph is charged with a crime, robbery with violence, which in Kenya is a capital offense. So now Joseph has just been handed a life sentence to sit in Nairobi Remand prison with no trial. Joseph's a Christian. So what does a guy like that do, like when he's praying to God to show up and to rescue him? And he's got a wife and five kids. Those kids are going to have to drop out of school to try to find some kind of work so they can scrape together some kind of meager existence. So IJM takes on Joseph's case. And in our global prayer gathering of 2012 in April, we actually prayed for. So once a year, we gather all of our field office directors from around the world, bring them together in D.C. It's April 3rd to 5th this year. Registrations are still open. And we pray that Joseph would be released, that his case would be heard and he'd be set free. So after 17 months in prison, his case finally comes up on the docket. Our attorneys show up at the court that day and discover the power is out. So typically, if the power's out, the judge just closes the courthouse. This is routine business in Nairobi. And it might be 17 more months before Joseph's trial would come back up on a docket again. So one of our attorneys, a really bright young woman there, runs to a nearby market and buys as many candles as she can hold. Runs back to the courthouse, and the judge sees her show up with all these candles. Judge is so inspired by her actions that he declares the courthouse is open. So it's by candlelight that Joseph's trial is heard, and then that day, a verdict of innocence is announced. And Joseph is able to go home and be with his wife and now six kids. So still today, like, we're still journeying with somebody like Joseph now, as he's still trying to recover. He's living in fear that the police are going to find him and retaliate. So we've got him, we've relocated he and his family. We're trying to help him start another marketplace in a different part of the city, where eventually he'll be able to support his family again. And so this is the reality that what most of the world's poor face today is a threat of what IJM we call everyday violence. And so people who are victims of human trafficking, particularly sex trafficking and bonded labor slavery, they're often abused and taken advantage of simply because the perpetrators of these crimes don't think there's any threat or recourse against them. And so most of the poor are just living with no safety. And Gary Haugen's latest book is called The Locust Effect. It's just come out. Is actually about reshaping the whole conversation around global poverty and how we see poverty. Because one of the top roadblocks that keeps people trapped in poverty, and this is like less than $2 a day, is just the threat of everyday violence. So I've been a compassion supporter for many years, child sponsorship. So we sponsor one compassion child for every one of our children. So we have three right now. And my wife and I had a compassion child before we had any of our own children. So for 17 years, we've been supporting compassion. And I love the organization. The very first compassion child we had was in Peru. And we had her for about 18 months. And then all of a sudden we got a letter from Compassion with a new child. And they said, we're not sure what happened to her. We were told she went to live with an uncle in another village. But here's your new child. And we didn't. We just thought, well, I guess that's normal in Peru. Okay. We look back on that now and we wonder, what really happened to that girl? And one of the things that we know for a fact happens now is girls stop going to school because they're victims of rape. So it's great that we have a school, and great that we're trying to educate, and great that we're feeding, and great that we're doing all these things. But if we don't stop the everyday violence that the poor are subject to, the potential for them to really escape poverty is limited. We've also done things like supported microloans through Kiva. Like, it's a great way to begin to develop people who can start a sustainable business. Love those kind of models. But in cultures where if you begin in some places to elevate above poverty and you're making some good money and you begin to be noticed, and then the police begin to come by and extort bribes from you, and if you don't pay the bribes, they just beat you or your wife or your children. The question is, how effective actually has that loan been? It's had some effect, but without the protection that will stop the violence against the poor, all of the work that we do. And we need to still do fresh water, medical, education, economic opportunity. It all still needs to happen. But what we're seeing for IJM is to address issues of darkness and injustice, really around the threat of everyday violence, something the church needs to enter into, and that we need to engage in full scale. So then I'll share one more scripture that's just like a proverb that I'm sure I read a dozen times, and it just never meant anything to me. It just never jumped out at me, and now I find it very heavy on my heart. Because the righteous care about justice for the poor. And this is NIV translation. So not this isn't my version or the IJM Bible or anything like that. This is just straight out NIV. The righteous care about justice for the poor, but the wicked have no such concern. So what I want to impress on you is the sense that God is a God of justice. He is a just God. And he has invited the church, his people, always to be participating with him in fighting against injustice, participating in the bringing about of his kingdom and the transformation of that. One of the things that that are always then asked with is, well, then how does a person or a church engage in this work? It is heavy. It can be very dangerous. And it's tricky. It's hard to figure out. It's very complex. So one thing I always want to say to people is that justice is not just like a fad thing that you can go into and do for a little while and then exit out of. If you're going to venture into the work of justice yourself or help lead a church in that direction, you've got to have a long-term view. There's two things we've learned in working with some of the violent bullies and criminals in the developing world. Those who take advantage of the poor, they're not very brave. And so if you create a credible deterrent, like a functioning public justice system, if they think, well, I might actually go to prison for doing this to somebody else, turns out that like prison in Mumbai is not really a destination where you want to live. And that actually creates a credible deterrent. So people will stop abusing the poor if they think they might go to jail for it. They might still be criminally involved, but we'd rather they steal toasters and microwaves than abuse little girls. So like that's one thing we just to create a credible deterrent because they're just not very brave. But the second thing is that they just think we'll go away because they've seen it. They've seen the Western church drop in, drop a few charitable grenades, paint a few buildings, do some nice things, and then they leave. And so this work of justice is about committing to stay for the long haul and to wade through it no matter how hard, how difficult, how long it's going to be to actually just commit to it because it's part of who we are as disciples. So it's a long-term view and to think both globally and locally. So IJM works our justice field operations work are only in the developing world, in places where people don't have a 911 call, where people don't have a functioning public justice system. But issues of injustice are global and local. So they're not all necessarily the same. The issues of human trafficking and bonded labor slavery are way more severe than they are here. There are issues domestically, to be sure. But the severity of them globally is at an exponentially different kind of scale. And there's no hope of rescue for most of them. Domestically, people trapped actually, especially with the growing awareness in our country of issues like human trafficking, sex slavery, labor slavery, domestic servitude, forced domestic servitude, all these things are being elevated to a place of awareness, which is really, really good for our country. So our work domestically is in a couple areas. One is in government advocacy. So we work to lobby our government to actually enforce our own laws better, but then also to work towards affecting global policy change around the way other countries and governments handle the issue of slavery. Church mobilization, that's where my role is. I'm the director of church mobilization for the Northeast. So how we actually as a church engage in the issues of justice on a global and local level. And church mobilization, some of the things we look for in a mobilized church, one is in prayer. Couldn't be more serious about the request for prayer. So the one piece of IJM material that I handed out to you is our prayer card. If you'd like to be a part of our prayer list to receive a weekly prayer update, and once a month if there's a key issue of timely or critical importance, we send out sort of news flash, kind of like a once a month sort of pray for this right now kind of thing. So if you'd like to be a part of that, our prayer team, I'd invite you just to fill that card out and give that to me today. You can also sign up for it on the website. I've never felt more desperate in the need to pray than I do now engaged in the work that I'm doing. I'll confess to you, most of my prayer life during the church was for things that I don't really know if I needed God to show up or not. God, can you make this event great? God, can you, you know, do something nice with Aunt Joan's gout? God, can you know? They're not that they're bad prayers, but I didn't pray them with much desperation. If you understand what I mean. But we're now in the issues and the places and the work that we're doing and fighting injustice and staring down darkness, shining light into the darkest places in the world. I feel a desperate need for people to be praying with us. So prayer, I mentioned our global prayer gathering as well, April 3rd through the 5th down in D.C. It's the best thing you can do to understand IJM without going to all of our field offices. We are in 18 different countries right now, or 18 different cities in 12 different countries. We have about 600 global staff. 95% of our staff are nationals in the countries where they serve. So we're hiring the best Christian attorneys, the best Christian aftercare professionals and social workers, the best Christian investigators, people with law enforcement backgrounds, that we can to do the work that we're doing in the field. So we really need prayer. We do ask for churches and church members to be generous and support us either by sending people to the field to serve as interns and fellows or by supporting our work financially. We want churches to engage in mission or injustice in their already existing places of mission. So it's not necessarily creating a justice team, but how do you see justice into the places you're already going? Because it's likely there are issues of injustice in those places that could be grown in an awareness and knowledge and then experience how you can proactively work as a church to fight those things. So existing mission opportunities. We also ask for churches to think about how you actually create and build your disciples, how you make disciples who understand that justice is a part of what it means to be a disciple. So if God is a just God, it's an essential part of God's character. How do you make disciples who understand and then do that kind of work of justice? So we have a lot of resources and ways like that that churches can be involved. So there's a whole... I could throw lots and lots of things at you, but part of what my job is to make it possible or easy or simple for you to respond. So there's not such an overwhelming thing. So this, I think it's great to have Dorothy here because one of the things Dorothy can actually give us is a little bit of a perspective on what's like one thing that a local church could know about and be involved in and ready to participate in a way then that can help in one part of the work that we have in caring for those who are victims of injustice. So I'm going to pass the mic over to Dorothy.
Thank you, Joe, for the pass off. My name is Dorothy Taft, and I'm pleased to tell you that I am the executive director of a new organization called the Market Project. But before I tell you about that, I also just want to add my congratulations and heap my praise on IJM, because I have witnessed them from their earliest days as an organization. I know what it's like to work with them on their advocacy front, and one thing that Joe and I were talking about before we started was one thing that I've always appreciated about the organization, that it has never lost its fervor and realization that the work they're involved in is a spiritual warfare. And when you engage the spiritual forces of darkness, we are absolutely foolish if we think that we can engage in that realm without being covered in prayer. So I really appreciate your never losing sight of that, and hopefully never will. So for the Market Project is a new organization, and we are focused on the employment piece of aftercare for those who've experienced trauma, exploitation, and trafficking. So our mission is to come alongside and partner with organizations like IJM, what we call aftercare organizations that are working with those who've come through trauma, come through exploitation, come through trafficking, and are beginning to help people put their lives back together again. And a critical part of aftercare is reintegration into community. And for instance, the LRA in Uganda has this long, very brutal history of abducting children, forcing them to commit crimes against their community and their family and in order to make them fearful ever to go back to their community, and then to bring them into the war. And so one of our early pilots, one of our first pilots, is actually working with adolescent mothers, young women who are mothers who were former child soldiers. And one of the challenges that this community has, this population has, is their families, for the most part, actually don't want them to come back. And so not only do you have the land tenure issues that IJM works on, those problems, but these young women don't really have a natural community to go back to. So they need to find a new community, but they're also faced with a real problem that they need to provide for themselves and their families. And so the Market Project creates businesses. We do the robust training of how to run a business. We provide a ready market for the products that would be made there, and be a continuation of that healing process for them to be integrated into society. The other pilot project that I wanted to mention to you is another opportunity for you to be engaged, is actually with a PCA ministry that works with a Native American tribe in Washington State. And we're excited to be coming alongside them. They have been ministering there for 11 or 12 years, working with a population of over 300 young people, primarily in their congregation. But the average life expectancy for this tribe is 39 years old. And you may ask, how can that be? And part of it is that the desperation of life in the reservation, there is no hope. There's no hope for jobs. There's desperation. There's drug abuse, alcoholism. And many of the young people get to a certain age and they realize, I have no way out of here. So we know that in the trafficking world here in the United States, many of, especially the young women on Indian reservations, are very vulnerable to trafficking. But young women and young men, they are without hope, and many of them actually commit suicide. And so the suicide rate is extremely high. So what we are going to be doing with this ministry, which is a PCA-started ministry, is walking alongside them, starting a business, creating jobs so that the young people have a place to work and to provide for themselves and to engage in a way that is filled with greater hope. So there are a couple things that you can do. We would love for you to join us in prayer. Because having worked on many of these issues for so long, I know from personal experience you cannot do this work without being covered in prayer. We also will be advertising in the next week or so two positions that are voluntary positions, actually. One is a senior entrepreneurial fellow. So we're looking for people who know how to run businesses, know how to start businesses, and can help us do the field research of this summer and spend the summer doing that. The other fellowship position is for, ideally, you know, a student, a college student who is a business major or maybe already has their major but hasn't yet found the job, but they want to apply what they've learned into a real life situation of creating a business. So we'd love for you to learn more about us. Let us know if you want to join us in this effort. So thank you.
Thank you, Dorothy. One more story that I'll share. So here's a story about like how sometimes trafficking works, and particularly in the bonded labor, slavery side of things. So the story about Shama. She's a young girl in India from a poor family, and she was the oldest of like three kids, and her mother gets pregnant, and day of delivery comes, and mom and baby both begin to go into distress. So the dad, recognizing that they need medical help, tracks down a doctor. And the doctor says, I'll come, but only if you can pay me the $35. Doesn't sound like much, right? But for Shama and her family, they've never seen $35 at one time. They live on less than a dollar a day. The dad is desperate, doesn't want to lose his wife, doesn't want to lose a baby, so goes to a moneylender, someone who can give him a loan, And that man says, I'll loan you the $35, but you need to give me one of your children for labor to pay off the debt. Absolutely desperate, the dad agrees. So they get the $35, doctor comes, baby's delivered, mom's okay. But Shama, then at 7 years old, is forced to go work for this man, and she sits with other kids on the man's front porch, and her job is to roll 2,000 cigarettes a day. If she doesn't get to 2,000, she's hit with a rubber hose. Now, supposedly she's working off the $35, but in reality, she's being charged exorbitant interest, and any time she breaks for lunch, she's charged. She's charged for the food she eats. So at the end of 2 years, her debt has actually increased. And the design of the system is very intentional to keep people trapped in slavery for generations. You have to keep working to pay off your debt, and you just can never get out. Absolutely illegal in India. And yet today there's as many as 14 million people in slavery. And so Shama just has to keep going, and this is now her life. Her little fingers will do this. So when she can know, when her fingers are, get too big to roll cigarettes, the moneylender would probably sell her into someone else, some other kind of labor, in order to make back his money, and someone else would assume that debt, and the cycle just continues. So when IJM hears about this story, hears about Shama's case, we're actually able to infiltrate and capture on video the moneylender's testimony. On his secret, we're undercover investigation, he actually tells us how he does his ring. And this IJM at this point is a pretty young organization. This is probably 12 years ago the story happened. So our team, we're about to bring this evidence. It's a Friday. We've got all the evidence. You know, we bring it to the police. The police see it, and they refer it to a judge to hear it, to decide whether or not we can move with the local police on this man. And so he sets the hearing for Monday. So team doesn't know what to do. They're in southern India. It's like 3 or 4% Christian in the state that they're in at the time. And so they say, well, we've got to find people we can pray with. And so on the Sunday night before the trial, they go, they find this little church, little Indian church, and they go there to pray. And that night, the Indian church has a guest speaker. It turns out, it would be none other than the judge who would hear the case the next day. Judge hears the case, is convinced that the stories that we're telling him are true and the proof is there. So then leads a team to raid that day released 12 child laborers for freedom. But then that goes on to bust a whole ring of over 420 children who are trapped in bonded labor slavery. And there's like a little way that God's like, come to me with the little things that you have and let me do a miracle. A fishes and loaves kind of moment. And this is the stuff we get to experience regularly at IJM. Just through the work we get to do and the commitment to prayer and trusting God, continuing to put ourselves out there and letting God be faithful and do the work he gets to do. So one of the other things, I gave you four things we see in churches. The fifth thing we like churches to do with us is just grow the movement. Awareness doesn't guarantee that you'll do anything about it, but not knowing guarantees you won't. And so we just like people to be able to find ways to talk about the realities of things like human trafficking and these injustices in the world. And so if you want to participate in that, even a simple way, you could just take one of these IJM bracelets as you leave, put it on your wrist, and hopefully someone will ask you about it. And you could say, you learned that there are over 30 million people in our world today who are trapped in slavery. And this is one way, one little way that you want to end slavery in our generation. And by our generation, I mean us who are alive in the church today can participate in ending global slavery. So if you want to help grow the movement, you can do that. You can take one of those. Yes, sir. Yeah, you can pass them around even. Good idea, David. We've got 20 minutes. I've got done in time to actually have some questions and conversations. So anything about what I've shared, what you've heard, from the scripture theology side of things to the work things, or if you have a question for Dorothy, we can pull her back up as well. Yes, sir.
Dave. How many, what about these Indians? Is this work on the reservation or off the reservation?
So we'll repeat the question so that it gets on the recording for those who aren't here. So David's question is about what about the Native Americans and the work of Is It on the Reservation?
This is a pilot that we are starting, and the enterprise will be in the vicinity of the reservation. It appears that we will need to have the business actually on land that is not owned by the reservation, and there are many reasons for that, which is probably not best to talk about right here.
Before coming here, I just Googled what was going on in Richmond on this subject, and I ran into an organization called Richmond
Justice Initiative.
Are you affiliated?
Questions about Jack Wheeler is asking about, Googled some things in Richmond and about the Richmond Justice Initiative. So that's Richmond Justice Initiative, RJI for short, is a independent organization, but its founder is a very committed IJM volunteer. So her convictions and dreams, passions, reasons for starting RJI is because she wanted to do more in state, but it's coming out of a passion. She actually is part of my church mobilization volunteer team, so she will speak for me on behalf of IJM at times. But RJI is functioning independent, and so there's no shared fundraising or no shared staff, other than I consider her one of my volunteer staff. So, but great organization, highly recommend it. And I guess in full disclosure, like, they've asked me to be on their board. I'm still discerning whether that's a good thing for me now, but they are working within the Richmond, in the Virginia government in Richmond to lobby and influence the way Virginia state laws, work against trafficking-related issues. They're also working on the prevention side, so awareness, prevention, advocacy, and they have education are their four things that they focus on. But they are driven out of Christian worldview to work in these same shared areas.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. What's usually your point of contact? Like, how do you hear about something?
Okay, good question. Point of contact, or how we hear about things. And so most of our work in the developing world we're at, it functions kind of like a law office, and so a lot of it's just by referral. So one family will provide relief to, and they will tell their friends, and their friends will know, and then they'll refer their friends who are in similar conditions or their family members. It's also by church. So Joseph's case, for example, that I shared, it was actually his pastor that informed the IJM office about what happened. And so every one of our field offices also has a church mobilization where we're working within those communities, in those churches, to help them engage the issues of justice. And so sometimes it's just by a phone call. Somebody has heard about us or saw us in court. So it comes through a lot of different ways, but we are very much, actually in a lot of places too, sometimes World Relief or World Vision, who are great partners in the field, will come across a client or a story or something, and they don't know what to do with it, but they know that person might need services that we offer. So one of our core operational values is partnership and bridge building. So we have great relationships with organizations who work with the poor. So, for example, another way is when we do win a conviction against a perpetrator, if Prison Fellowship is active in that city, we'll often refer that convicted individual, give that name to Prison Fellowship to have them follow up with, so that they can begin to work with the clients that way. Yeah. So
there's a lot of networking with
organizations. Tons of it. And some of you who have experience in the global mission field will probably recognize this too. But the church plays a lot nicer with each other in the developing world than we tend to here. Yeah. So it's a much bigger sandbox, a lot less walls than what we think of. So it's a lot of communication with the organizations in that way. Good question. What else? Yeah.
Joe, I would imagine that you guys would easily be overwhelmed with all kinds of requests to look into cases of slavery and other trafficking kind of issues.
Yeah, so are we inundated or overwhelmed with the number of cases and referrals? Well, I mean, yes and no. It can be Offices have a good way of sort of figuring out which things they need to follow up on, which ones are most pressing, where we might have a chance to win some case, where we can actually be a helpful, you know, presence. And our offices are they're pretty much in cities, and so they have boundaries to which. So if it's just too far away, we'll just have to say no to some things that we just can't get to at this point. Ultimately, what we're trying to do, so we always work with the local police and local law enforcement, local government officials. So we're actually, I mean, eventually we want to be able to leave and trust that the system there will be a functioning public justice system that defends the poor. And so in places like Uganda, we're actually training the police in Uganda on property rights for widows. And most of the police precincts now in Rwanda have a desk dedicated to widow land grabbing or illegal property seizure. And they have a notebook, so if somebody comes in complaining about someone trying to run them off their land, they open a drawer and they take out their manual, which IJM created, and they open that up. And then they also host sort of community awareness things where they actually gather in widows and educate them about their land rights. So we have this great story in Rwanda just a couple months ago. Some bullies kind of came and tried to start running this widow off her land, and she had been to one of these IJM trainings. And she went into her house and she grabbed the IJM manual and she came out and she started shaking it at them. And she chased them off their land because she said that she had rights, and this book told her. And then she went to the police desk. And the officer, when she came in, he opened his drawer, he took out his IJM manual, and they found the law code. So the police went back with the widow, and they told these neighbors, hey, you can't do this. And he waved his IJM manual at those guys. So she's not been bothered again.
The justice mojo.
She had some strength, justice strength. So we're actually trying to do things where we can scale our work so that the police and the systems there, the infrastructure, actually handles the burden. And so that's kind of what we have to be able to do, is just sort of slowly mobilize and educate and build capacity as best we can. Yeah.
So you said most of your staff are local attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what will they do as you hand over? It looks like you'll hand over a lot to them.
Yeah. So all of our question that has been asked is, what about, so if we're hiring local staff, what are they going to do if IJM leaves the country? A couple things. One is that a lot of times if we're leaving, it's because the government or organizations have stepped up in country that can do that. So if we're able to shut down an IJM office, the people who work there for us, we're sure we're going to be well qualified to find positions or lead in other ways on even national levels. Two is sometimes we'll take some of the best talent from an office that we might be closing and move it to one that we're opening. So, for example, this just happened recently in India. Our bonded labor slavery work was in Chennai. But we have a whole bunch of stuff happening up on the north. Chennai's in the south, whole bunch of bonded labor work on the north side of India, but not an office there. So we moved a big part of our bonded labor slavery team to Delhi, to New Delhi. And they are now, they've relocated, and so they're able to resource now all the work that's going on in the northern of India. Yeah. Mr.
Actually, I have a series of questions. Let me ask them one at a time.
Okay.
Do you work with missionaries? Do missionaries often refer people to you?
Okay, so do we work with missionaries? Yes. So we'll take referrals from missionaries as they hear about these things. And so especially in India, a lot of the Western missionaries in India know of our work there. So as they come across cases, they're referring them to our office. Yep.
And are there countries that won't let you come in?
Are countries that won't let us come in? Yes. And there's countries that we won't go into. So just for example, like we've looked at a number of countries in Eastern Europe. And for now, at least, the Russian mafia is a particularly violent brand of organized crime that most state governments aren't ready to take on. So we just won't go there because we can't keep our people safe if we go there. Countries that are real strict Sharia law, that are Islam, won't allow Christians to practice law in the courts. So those are, and we're only going to hire Christians. At least for now, it's our policies. We're only hire Christians. So we won't be in any country that's under Islamic rule or Sharia law. And so there are places that we've tried even to get into and then been unwelcomed. And there are places like India that they could kick us out. Like if they, for some reason, think that we're proselytizing, they could kick us out, shut us down. So we're the places like the Philippines, which is 80% Catholic and 15% Protestant, we're very welcome and seen as a huge ally to their work. So it's a very, very much country to country.
Right. And my last question is, the amount of cases of injustice in the world, it's so much more than what you're able to grapple with, obviously. You're just scratching the surface.
Yep.
But what is the main thing that prevents the organization from growing? Is it money? Is it personnel? Is it opportunities? What is the thing that holds? I mean, you may be growing fast. I don't know.
So the question is, injustice in the world is huge, and we're a small organization, which we are compared to that. Just a couple of numbers for reference. Some estimates have the human trafficking industry at $32 billion annually. And IJM last year just got over, just scratched over $40 million. So $40 million against $32 billion is, yeah, it's not very much. And so that's worldwide. So what prevents us from growing the most is financial. Like we just can't, we need to be able to hire staff. And so if we had an unlimited source of funding, we could grow a lot faster. God's been really just gracious to us and the church and people have been generous to us. So, we grew all the way through 2008. 2007, 2008, 2009, through all the recession, our numbers still increased. It never feels like it's increasing fast enough to meet the demand. That's why it's such a matter of prayer and a huge matter of faith is because.
So you have more people wanting to become part of your organization than you can hire, basically.
Yeah, there is, and there are some places just there are hard positions to fill, so there's positions that are open. And you're looking for another second career opportunity, the IJM job opportunities page has got some really interesting, fascinating, fun positions on it. But it is difficult to find someone who has the right qualifications to serve in certain places. There are pretty specialized needs, and then when you add the faith piece to it, so there's a challenge in that too. So it's not just money; it is finding the right people to do. To do the work too.
It's pretty much like locating full-time missionaries.
It is. If you do it right, it's actually a really hard and discerning and strategic process. If you're just throwing people out there, you're going to end up with more fires and messes.
Sure. Yeah. You wind up with more harm than good.
More harm than good. Yeah.
What
good.
About the attorneys that are out there? Are they all mission supported, or are they able to get a little bit of a local support or maybe?
No, none of our staff has to raise funds. So there's our office in DC, and we have an office in five partner offices: Canada, Australia, UK, Netherlands, and Germany, that raise all of the funds to support all of our staff in the field. Yep.
So out there on the field, I guess because of the type of work they do, there's not much help, much hope for them to. Becoming self-sufficient.
In terms of our staff? Oh no, all of our staff could have very profitable careers in law enforcement or as lawyers. They're choosing often to work to defend the poor out of just a conviction. And we'll pay them a fair wage, but yeah, they're not getting rich doing it. But they all could be doing independent work. They're choosing to work for us. Yeah.
I was thinking some of them on the field might be tempted to have a private practice to support this and do this 50% of the time and that 50% of the time.
I don't think so. That's not the kind of people we're looking for. We're looking for people who are really sold out to it. Yeah. Yep.
Let's say you go into India and you catch the ringleader.
Mm-hmm.
Can you do any, but let's say the law is okay, he goes to jail for 3 months and it all starts again. Can you, if the laws are weak in a country, can you do anything to help make them stronger,
mm-hmm.
so the punishment fits the crime?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so are we doing anything with laws to make sure punishment fits the crime? Actually, what we see is when we... So, take India, for example. You mentioned that one. Before we started trying cases of slavery in India, it had been 100 years since anyone had gone to prison on those charges. Once we started winning some cases, it turns out the laws that were in place 100 years ago were really steep in their punishments. So, for example, like in India, you can get life imprisonment for rape if the evidence and things are there. So, in some ways, we'd go, "Whoa, like life? That sounds really so." So, it's really highly varied. We do a lot of government advocacy work wherever we can in our offices, and we end up getting to meet with just some incredible people, high-ranking officials who are interested in our work. To strengthen the law. And we're not really trying to tell a culture what's an appropriate punishment. We just say if someone's abusing someone else violently like this, there ought to be something that prevents that kind of behavior and action. So we are involved with advocacy efforts. And there's other great organizations too, like Amnesty International, there's some other advocacy government, some other NGOs that strictly do government advocacy work. So we do find that it's just helpful to work from any angle we can approach the problem. Yeah.
I have a question. Joseph's story. Was there any follow-up on the police officers? I mean, he's perpetrated a pretty severe crime. I mean, was there anything done?
Yeah, so any follow-up on the police officers in Joseph's case? It's tricky, because what we're trying to do everywhere is to have the police engage in the right kind of behavior. We don't want to make enemies out of the police, but we also don't want them to be doing that kind of stuff. And this is what we have found also as an organization that, and this seems sort of typical of human organizations, that there's about, there's about, there'll be 10 or 20% of the people who are in it for really right, pure, good reasons. There are 10 or 20% who are in it for selfish or corrupt or wicked reasons. And there's this huge middle ground, 60 to 80%, that are more or less going to go with the flow. Like whoever's getting the attention or the promotions or the money, they're going to go with that. So if we can find, when we find that 10 or 15% of the police who are in it for the right reasons, and then those guys start getting attention, they start getting recognized, they start getting celebrated, their names in the paper for the right reasons, like all those things start happening, what we actually see is there starts to create this momentum change. And so that more and more of the police actually want that kind of attention, not the kind they might get from actually behaving badly. And so part of our strategy always is to find the ones that we can trust and sort of grow that team, grow that network. So in Joseph's case, from the last thing that I heard about it is that we have pressed charges against those officers, but it hasn't gone anywhere, which is pretty typical for developing world court systems at this time. So, yeah, great question. Very intuitive, very insightful. We've done our part. We'll see if the Lord opens doors on that or not. So I think there's 1 minute left. So you have a quick follow-up?
What about the bullies in Rwanda?
Yeah, there's lots of them.
Right.
Yeah.
If they're coming in and they're causing these troubles, and the cop has waving a manual, is he actually coming after them as well?
Yeah, so since that particular story, there was no crime actually perpetrated other than the threat. And so that's a crime, but not enough to arrest or win conviction. One of the things we celebrated the end of last year was there were 9 particularly violent ex-LRA members who were persecuting this one widow, chasing her off her land, like violently with spears and clubs and things. It turned out when we started talking to other people in the community, they were sort of terrorizing the whole area. We actually had, in order to get all 9 of them together at one time, we had to set up a really major sting. So we fabricated a charcoal sale And eight of the nine showed up at one place at one time, and the police were able to get all eight of them. And they were, one of them was a brother who was still on the loose, but we think he's fled into the bush. They never find him. But eight of those nine were all apprehended and were still in custody as of last I heard of it. So we are making progress. Like, there is hope, and but it's really hard work, and it's difficult, and it's long, and this is why we just need prayer and churches around the world to be stepped up doing it with us. Yeah.
One other real quick one. Is there any relationship with the Christian Legal Society?
Yeah, so just good partners with us. I think we collaborate where we can. The attorneys, that's a little bit outside of my expertise. So the attorneys at IJM probably know a lot of other attorneys in the Christian Legal Society and Association. But yeah, yep, always looking for bridges and partnerships where we can. Thank you all for your attention. There is an IJM table down there where there are some other resources. I brought four books that you could look at. If you want to if you can't find me and you want to drop off the prayer card, you could do that there. There's a few other things that you could pick up, just sort of about our work if you want as well, and I'll be there to answer any other questions. Thank you so much.
You.
Let me pray for you all just real quick. Father, thank you so much for these people who are interested in your heart for justice and who want to participate in your fight to end slavery in this generation. I do pray that we'll continue to see in the church here in this country and around the world come more alive for your passion for those who are poor and oppressed and vulnerable. And that we'll be people who will participate in this work with you, that we'll just do what you've asked us to do, to be the hands and feet of Jesus, to love the vulnerable, to love the poor, to give them protection, to rescue them. So God, let us be the people in the church that you dream that we can be. In Jesus' name, amen.